Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show, and my name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he is with us every month. It's always on a Thursday, and we invite your questions on children's health. It can be, just about anything you'd think of asking a pediatrician. We've talked about a lot of different things in the past. We've talked about all the various childhood illnesses. We've talked about immunizations. We've talked about what to do if you got a piggy eater. We've talked about sports and participation in sports and growth and development issues, all that kind of stuff. Anything that you could imagine discussing with a pediatrician is certainly fair and game on this show. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
Your suggestion was maybe to start out here. We might talk a little bit about treating ear infections because lately there has been something about that in our press and maybe not just in our press about how doctors are thinking about that now, what's the proper treatment, and maybe, again, this all revolves around the question of do you or do you not give antibiotics?
Yeah, don't use antibiotics, and I think that's not what's being really preached at all. It's use antibiotics appropriately, and I think that's what the new treatment guidelines are about for the treatment of ear infections. Ear infections, I think we've talked about bunch in the past. We haven't talked about it for a while. Usually an ear infection starts out with a cold, something that clogs up the eustachian tube that drains the middle ear into the nasopharynx, and then you don't have good cleansing up there, and bacteria probably are always up there because it's connected to the nasopharynx, and if you block it so it can't get cleansed, you can get bacterial infection in there. And that causes a lot of pain and may cause fever in the younger children. And I think there's still no doubt in the new treatment guidelines those kids get and deserve an antibiotic. And they're still recommending that the antibiotic to start with is amoxicillin. Good old amoxicillin has been around for decades now. It tastes good. They've increased the dosage recommendation a little bit, and you take it for about 10 days or so, and usually it works. If it doesn't work, then you go up to the next antibiotic, to a group that's more likely to get resistant bacteria. But the next ear infection, they get well from the first ear infection. A month later, you get another ear infection. You start out with amoxicillin again. So I think for parents out there listening, don't go to the doctor and say, you know what, amoxicillin never works, because I think the guidelines now are, next ear infection starts out with amoxicillin. What's so great about amoxicillin? Well, it is inexpensive, it's well-tolerated, it tastes good, and it's a relatively narrow-spectrum antibiotic. So we're not using a broad-spectrum antibiotic when we need a narrow-spectrum antibiotic. So hopefully we're going to create less resistant bacteria this way. And I think what the new guidelines do is they say, doctor, make sure you've got the right diagnosis. Many of you, I'm sure, can recall you've had the cold. Okay, all of a sudden, one ear you can't hear very well out of. And you're jumping up and down trying to get the water out of your ear. And what that is that's the blocked eustachian tube. And that's otitis media with the fusion. That is not an ear infection. That does not get antibiotics. Usually those will resolve all by themselves with time. And what they're saying is, reserve the antibiotics for the kid who is in pain, the kid who has appropriate physical findings on exam, not the pink ear. We're talking about the red bulgy ear, because the pink ear, if a child comes in with 103 fever, their face is kind of flushed and pink, and guess what? Their eardrum is kind of flushed and pink too, and a fever doesn't get an antibiotic, an ear infection gets an antibiotic.
A parallel sort of situation is, say you've got a kid who's got a sore throat, and so you think you're suspecting strep. Now, I guess my understanding, and from having talked about this before, is that what you really ought to do is you ought to do a throat culture.
Yes.
And find out, in fact, there is strep. Don't just look at it. Kids has got a sore throat. They feel terrible, and it looks red, so you figure, okay. and you give it. You don't want to do that. And now, is it clear in the case of ear infection that it's not, you can just look at symptoms and make the determination, okay, what we really got here is an infection, and in this case, it is appropriate to give the antibiotic.
Yes, because, yeah, a culture, well, theoretically, you shouldn't grow much of anything out of the middle ear, but the other problem about culturing a throat is easy. Cotton tip swab on the tonsils, you send it off to the lab for a rapid strep test, and you can get the results back in 10, 20, 15, 20 minutes. But an ear infection, what you'd have to do is drain the middle ear. So you'd have to put a needle through the eardrum into the middle ear, which is done, and it's safe to do, but most people look at that a little bit askance, and it's generally not necessary to know the specific organism, because we know with good odds that it's one of three or four anyway. And again, amoxicillin is the drug of choice, should take care of 90%+ of what's in there. And if not, you'll regroup a day or two later if they don't get better and switch antibiotics.
Yeah. I think some parents have kids who are just plagued with ear infections. They just seem to have one after another. And I'm sure that when you're in the middle of that, you're thinking to yourself, is this ever going to end? Are we ever going to have an end to that problem? And you would say, to echo your one of your more famous pronouncements, this too shall pass. It's, you know, no, it really is true that they'll grow out of it. How, what sort of period of time are we looking at?
Okay, age 5. By age 5, ear infections are really rare. And the other thing we know with these kids who've had one ear infection on top of another, by age 5, the ear infections are very rare. Hearing's normal and speech is normal. So they seem to, for the most part, have suffered no damage. And I think I would be even a little bit more encouraging than that. Usually by age 3, the frequency of ear infections is really coming down. So folks, hang on out there. Once your child hits their 3rd birthday, I think you're going to see ear infections become quite rare. And I think by age 5, you're going to see them become things of the past.
And is this the issue? It has to do with the growth, the development of the child, and the ability, essentially, of the ear to clear itself.
Yeah.
So that you don't get those kind of blockages that you're talking about.
And I think the other thing we're talking about is the number of colds kids get. There's a quota, and by the time they hit age 5, assuming they've been in preschool and all that sort of stuff, usually by the time they hit age 5, the numbers of colds they're getting per year are decreasing, and so we don't have the setup to block the eustachian tubes to cause to let an ear infection start.
Mm. And just to go back to the other thing, I'm sure that that's also a worry of parents, that if you have a lot of ear problems, if they seem to have a lot of blockages, you start to wonder, well, is this going to affect their hearing, and is that going to affect their language development? Yeah. And you say you probably don't have to worry
about that. Yeah, it will affect their hearing over the short run for, 2, 4, 6 weeks with an ear infection. But in the long run, what they're finding is by age 5, hearing is normalized and speech is perfectly normal.
Is it standard procedure at some point in those early years to do some kind of hearing testing?
Ooh, hearing testing is awfully hard to do. Hmm. Probably, inexpensively, it's hard to do. There's more expensive ways you can do it. But as far as, probably under age 3 to, put up your hand when you hear the beep is kind of questionable whether you're going to get valid results. There's other ways to do it. You can do auditory evoke potentials. You can do the sound. Our ear makes sound. And you can measure, if the ear is functioning normally, you can measure the sound that our ear makes. So that, but these are more expensive ways. And again, generally, this is not necessary because we do know that over time they're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if there was a problem, it would be noticeable enough so that you would, or would you, say if there was a problem, would a parent know now something really is wrong here that maybe should have some special attention?
Yeah. That's a bit problematic too, and I think that's why this state has mandatory hearing screening in the newborn period. Because, and I've been here myself, and I wasn't comfortable being there. Before hearing screening, mandatory hearing screening in the newborn nursery, Clinical diagnosis of congenital deafness was often not made till the child was 18 months to 2 years of age. You didn't pick anything up. Mm-hmm. They learned to lip read. They learned to, and they weren't expected to have well-developed language themselves. And unfortunately, it was late in diagnosis. Hearing screening in the newborn period is problematic in that you'll pick up most of the kids most of the full-term healthy newborn babies who failed the hearing test probably don't have a hearing deficiency. It's a false positive reading on the test. So a failed hearing test in the newborn nursery doesn't mean necessarily that your child's got a hearing problem, but it means that further follow-up, further testing needs to be done to make sure that this child has normal hearing or to see if this child needs to be in a hearing-impaired program at a relatively early age.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's on the program every month. It's always a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we talk about children's health. It's your opportunity to call with questions. Now, whatever might happen to be on your mind, as long as it has to do with kids and their health and development, the kinds of things you would talk about with a pediatrician, you are certainly welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call around Illinois or Indiana, use that one, and that's 800-222-9455. One of the things that we've talked about, I think, a couple of times fairly recently, and I don't know if you had a chance to think some more about this, was this recommendation that apparently came out of the American Academy of Pediatrics about children and television watching. And I know you remember essentially they sort of laid down a blanket kind of statement that said, for young children, and I'm not sure that I was ever quite sure what exactly that meant, what age range?
I think they said under two.
Under two, okay. So they were saying, essentially they were saying, we shouldn't let them watch television at all. And it was not just, not a lot, a little bit. Okay, they were saying no. None at all. And I guess we were a little bit uncertain about, well, why that was and just how critical that was.
I think the best data I could find or the best explanation for what that was all about is that these children need interaction with other people, with other human beings, okay. Not just the unidimensional human being on TV. And so I think
it was not so much television itself, but it was the idea of television to the exclusion of
human contact and human interaction. When we talk about some of the programs, we do know that Sesame Street is a good program, that it really does help kids learn. But how many hours out of the day is Sesame Street on? I think it's not on 1 hour. I think WLL may show it 2 half-hour, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, or something like that. So, rest of the time. Folks, you created these children. They need some investment of your time and money.
I think also maybe just a slightly different but related question has to do with video games. And I do remember in the past there having been some concern, particularly for some children, about what that experience would do. And I guess I'm not thinking about the fact that they were violent or that it would have values that you didn't like, but of the effect of that kind of stimulus on the brain. And what it would actually do, particularly if there was a lot of flashing and there was a lot of rapid movement, and that for some kids, for example, kids who might have a tendency towards seizures, that might actually be that could actually trigger a seizure.
The photic stimulation, can trigger seizure, but that does happen, and it usually makes the news when it happens. But it is a rare event, and I think mostly what we're concerned with the video games, again, is the graphic violence, and there seems to be some undeniable data out there now that all this exposure to violence desensitizes and perhaps disinhibits these kids from being able to rein themselves in and set limits on their own behavior, and may increase the violent behavior of kids and young adults.
So there's more reason to be worried about that than any kind of physiological thing.
Probably,
for most children.
I think the photostimulation caused seizures are real, but they're infrequent.
How much are we seeing these days of seizure disorders in children? Is it pretty much what it always was?
I think it's constant. Yeah, I don't think we're seeing any increase or decrease. While we're still talking about television and we talk about the increase in attention deficit disorder, one thing, and I don't know that this is ever researched, and I think this is probably just me. I wonder if we haven't created short attention spans with television. If we haven't created a 10-minute attention span, and then the teacher needs to go and do a little commercial break and do a little jingle and song and dance, and then she can teach for another 10 minutes and then needs to go into another commercial break. And I just wonder if we haven't, is attention deficit disorder, what is it? Mm-hmm. It's probably more than one thing. And has our society and what we do with TV helped create it?
Yeah. Just the other day I was struck, I saw for the first time a commercial advertisement on television for a medication, a prescription medication to treat adult attention deficit disorder. Now, I don't ever remember having seen that before, and I guess I do understand that people in talking about ADD saying that it's not really something that you grow out of. That the intensity may lessen, and it may be the kind of thing that if a person comes to understand, they can develop coping strategies, ways of being in the world that will minimize the problems for them of having that. But it's not really something that ever goes away. But now I guess that's the first time I ever saw somebody pushing a product that says, if you're an adult and you have this, here, we've got something for you.
And, it is. I think attention deficit disorder is a hard diagnosis. I feel much more comfortable making diagnosis when I have a lab or an x-ray or a physical, an objective physical finding that says, hey, yeah, you're right. With this, if you've got 4 off of column A and 5 symptoms off of column B, this is what you got and this is what you're supposed to be on. It just makes me, as a physician, a little bit more uncomfortable. I think my psychiatry colleagues, well, that's what they do for, I mean, most of their diagnoses are off of column A and column B, but it makes me a little bit more uncomfortable. But I think if you say that people with attention deficit disorder have a biochemical disorder or wiring or problem or whatever you want to blame it on, why should we assume that with age it's going to go away? It's going to mature away. And it does tend to get better. The brain is relatively plastic in childhood and adolescence, more plastic than it is in adults. So maybe it can correct some of the wiring problems or the chemical problems or whatever you want to blame it on. But why should it go away? And I think the other thing we as adults do is we can get around it because we're not mandated to sit and listen to somebody for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours. We can work for a period of time, and when we feel the urge to stretch our legs, we can go on a coffee break.
Yeah. We're now getting to this point where we're starting to sort of to make the transition from winter into spring, where it's going to be more possible to be doing stuff outside and where kids may be a little bit more active. And I'm also thinking that we don't quite have maybe quite as many sport opportunities in spring, but I guess we do move into things like cross country and track and baseball and soccer. I guess. Do you find that once we get through the winter and it gets more and more possible to be doing things outside, that with kids you start to see a little tick up in sports injuries because they've been kind of off and now they're going out there and they want to go full at it right out?
Yeah, I've always noticed that. 2 times a year we have an increase in injuries. One is, the first warm weather of spring when everybody leaves the house at once and they start doing things that they haven't done for 3 or 4 months, so they're not quite Yeah. They've lost some of their suppleness. They've lost some of their skills. They need to regain them. And they crash their bikes more often than that. Then the next time you see it again is in the fall, right after school starts. Because these kids have sat in the schoolroom all day long. And when the school bell rings, they all pile on their bikes at once and pile into each other and that sort of stuff. But, yeah, we will see more accidents, more sprains and strains and that sort of thing. I don't know that it's a public health problem. It's just going to happen. I think we see it more. I think we see it as much amongst adults, too. You know, I'm going to turn that garden over today.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, all of a sudden the back, yeah, the next, yeah, they go to work Monday with this awful backache.
So you only do sports physicals, only sports physicals really are done in the summer, in the run-up to the beginning of school?
No. Yeah, you know, we're going to do some, they're probably doing some sports physicals now for track. So, yeah, you'll do sports physicals with the season of the sport.
Oh, okay.
So then late summer football comes, and then basketball comes a little bit later.
Yeah.
Although most kids now seem to be involved in multiple sports, so one sports physical will take. So we don't see the
Well, that's the groups. I wondered about that, too, whether in fact that they were those that are going to be the most active, most involved, are going to do several things, and so they're going to their level of activity may not change all that much when you move from the outside into the inside because there are enough things. There's basketball, there's volleyball, there, you know, whatever kinds of things that they're going on that you can do inside during the wintertime. Those things are still going.
So it's fun to watch these kids grow. It's fun. It's interesting to see these kids take on a terrible load and succeed with it more than any adult would want to do. But they're in school all day long, and they're getting A's and B's. They're in sports. They're in music programs. And these kids are really busy, and most of them are doing very well with it. And it's just a joy to see these kids.
So how do you know when it's too much, though?
You let the kids say. Usually what I do is I talk to the parents and say, boy, you know, your kid's in an awful lot of stuff, an exhausting amount of stuff. As long as they enjoy it, that's fine. If they ever want to back out of something, if they ever say, whoa, I'm a little bit overloaded, and usually kids will be honest about that. All of a sudden, they don't like soccer, or they don't like trumpet, or they don't like gymnastics, or something like that. If they're doing well in everything else and busy and socially active in that, probably, yeah, really think about it and let them back out of, let them drop something.
Yeah. I guess the thing that I wonder is whether, you know, at a particular time, maybe they'll feel overloaded and they'll look for something to shed. And then, you know, I guess I would wonder, well, later are they going to say, well, you know, that was a pretty tough time and it's true that I had to kind of lay back on that particular thing. But they might say, maybe they never get back to it, and maybe later they say, gee, I wish that I had. You know, I wish I'd kept playing the trumpet or whatever it was.
Well,
I suppose you can always go. You can always go back.
Wouldn't we always? Yeah, boy, don't. Yeah, how long could you and I say, gee, I wished I'd have developed this gift or skill more than? And
we could probably spend a couple hours.
We could spend a couple hours, and I think again, I think it's important to let our kids investigate and sample. And I think it's important then to let them choose. I think probably the best example is kids in gymnastics. You know, they start at 5 or 6, and you know, gymnastics programs say, boy, you know, I think this kid's got the potential to be an Olympic gymnast. Okay. And then all of us, all of a sudden it's a 4 or 5 evening a week thing or afternoon a week thing with gymnastics. And then all of a sudden, about 10, 11, 12, a lot of these kids start dropping out, just saying that, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. And you say, that's fine. I think they've still gotten the benefit of gymnastics. And if they want to do something else, that's fine. Except not TV. That's TV's okay, but yeah, within limits.
Yeah. We are at our midpoint here, and we'd be happy to have whatever questions you have. It doesn't have to be on anything that we've talked about. It could be on anything that you could imagine asking a pediatrician. That's what we do on the show once a month. We talk about children's health with our guest, pediatrician Dr. Robert Bocek. It's always a Thursday. That's the 10 o'clock hour. We built it into the schedule as a regular feature because we thought that folks would always have questions. So if you want to call in, talk with the doctor, you can do that very easily by picking up the telephone and dialing the number 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Here where we are, we do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller to talk with in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Have the doctor say a few words about the ADD and the hyperactive problems with children and a possible remedy by using different kinds of supplements, not only vitamins, but minerals as well. Because
okay.
I have heard that that has a great deal to do with that. So let's hear what the doctor has to say.
All right.
Okay. I guess I'm going to have to plead ignorance because I'm not aware that I've seen any great published studies about the homeopathic treatment, the vitamins, foods, nutritional supplements on treatment of attention deficit disorder. I will respond from what there is attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity and without hyperactivity, but I can't. I really am not no position to comment on non-medical treatments.
Is it the case still that this is not a terribly well? These are not terribly well understood. If we ask the question, well, what's going on here? What causes this?
Yeah,
do we
I
really
don't
know.
No. And I think there's been some talk about underactive or over. And I think what they're talking about now is that there's an underactive part of the brain that's supposed to kind of be a traffic flow type of system, a switching system that's underactive. So it's not that the brain's hyperactive, it's just that the brain is not kept organized. And that's why it's happening. But I think that's not proven. It's a speculation, and we don't know.
Yeah, some of the older medications are stimulants, and that's always, I'm sure to a lot of people, that has always seemed counterintuitive.
Yeah.
If the problem is that a kid is overactive, that you would give them a stimulant, but that does in fact seem to help. Now, also, though, more recently, I think I've seen again advertised medications to treat ADD or ADHD. And it says very specifically that it is not a stimulant. Are there some newer things, and how are they different from the medications that we have been using now for as long as we've been talking?
Yeah, the non-stimulant one, how does that work? I think that's a congener of epinephrine. So it's sort of a stimulant, but it's been changed enough that it doesn't have a natural – yeah. That if you or I took it, we wouldn't feel stimulated. But again, that's the theory that we've got this underactive part of the brain. If we stimulate that, it will do its job and keep everything better organized.
Okay. We have some other callers. We have somebody on the cell phone. We'll go to them in the Charleston area. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have four children, and they range in age from 9 to 1. So I have a couple questions, then I'll ask them and hang up. My oldest is 9, and she seems to be just getting heavier and heavier. None of my other children seem to have the problem, so I'm not sure what to do. I have a friend of hers' mother put her child on the Atkins diet, and I just wonder if that's something you should do to her. She's 9. I just didn't know if you should do things like that where you cut out carbs, or although my daughter seems to be a meat lover. And my second question is, I have two boys who are relatively young, and we try to limit what they watch, although they see SpongeBob and Blue's Clues and some Pokemon movies. But it just seems like, compared to my daughter, they do much more fighting games and not actually fighting each other in anger, but, playing war and things like that. And I just wondered, should I stop that? Is that normal boy play? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Thank you.
A 9-year-old girl getting overweight. You know, I'm not a big fan of the Atkins diet. I'm not a big fan of the grapefruit diet or anything like that. I think she needs to, well, I think what may be going on is she may be at the age where she's starting to go into puberty. And boys, not girls, are supposed to get a belly and a butt before they go into puberty, but we'll see some girls do that too. As puberty's starting, and age 9, you know, that's certainly a possibility, we'll see these kids getting a little bit overweight. And I think I'd watch her diet. I'm not sure I'd put her on the Atkins diet or any diet like that again, but I'd watch, yeah, her diet in general, her portion size, her snacks, how much TV she's watching. Maybe her TV needs to be cut back a little bit because, again, the amount of time spent watching TV correlates directly with obesity. And I think, what's the reason behind that? Well, when you're watching TV, you're not burning many calories, and every commercial break you have a chance to get up and get a snack. But I think mostly if she's been normal weight all along, now at age 9 she's getting a little bit chubby looking, I would best guess is she's probably getting ready to start puberty. As far as your son's being much rougher than boys, I guess I don't know exactly how to answer that. Is that nature or nurture? And I think a lot of it is probably the XY chromosome versus the XX chromosome. It's just like the little boy deers with their just getting to be their antlers, their button heads, and we see that with, yeah, male animals seem to have kind of a rougher play than female animals, and I think a lot of this is just probably the nature of the male. And you're there to supervise it, and I think that, you know, there needs to be a referee there to say, okay, guys, it's getting, you know, I will allow this to a certain extent because I really can't stop it, but you know what? It's getting past the point of fun. It's getting a little serious. Somebody's going to get hurt. Go to your rooms. Let's do something else. But yeah, it's a male thing. I'm sure the phone lines will probably light up pretty soon, and I think it needs to be super. Yeah, I think it needs to be allowed, but I think it needs to be supervised and limited.
And just to go back to the other thing real quick, and I think that I've seen some articles about this, that with the popularity particular of diets like Atkins, adults are putting themselves on those diets and saying, well, you know, this seems to be good for me. I think that there is a concern, particularly for young children, that you really don't want to put them on severely restricted fat. You don't want to severely restrict their fat. That's not good. And it's probably anything that is going to take one category and severely restrict it or you know, do odd things with the diet, it's probably not a good idea. And as best as you can with children, it probably also is good to stick with the more traditional kind of advice about, you know, the pyramid and the well-rounded diet, and you want them to have their fruits and vegetables and
encourage activity. Yeah,
exactly. You know, all that basic, you know, that kind of basic stuff that your mainline nutritionist probably is going to tell you.
Because the Atkins diet, again, if you put a low carbohydrate diet, you know, the emphasis is on meat. Fat also comes along with the meat, so it's going to be a relatively high fat diet. So then those people that have, particularly the adults that were worried about their cholesterol, and maybe we're worried about kids' cholesterol too, it's probably not a good idea. And I think, you know, my physiology professor in medical school, and this was a long time ago, said that weight control is just a matter of calories in, calories out. For adults who aren't growing anymore, it's calories burned up in activity versus how many you eat. And if you eat 3,000 calories a day and burn up 1,000 calories a day in activity, you got a surplus of 2,000 calories a day that the body's going to put into fat. Now, with kids, we have a third factor in there. Kids need some calories to grow on. But still, if you exceed the calories needed for activity and growth, the body's not going to waste them. It's going to store them, and the child's going to get obese. And I think right now, what, obesity's up there as far as the Center for Disease Control is concerned as the number one health care problem in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess the other thing, talking about activities, you know, I look around our neighborhood, and every driveway has a basketball hoop in it. And it's surprisingly how infrequently I see kids shooting baskets. May see dad out there shooting baskets, probably without the kids. And I don't, you know, I think this probably reflects badly on what's going on. And you see a baseball diamond at every park we have in town. Yet do you ever see kids playing baseball there unless they're suited up for a organized game? I remember when I was a kid, how many kids did you need to have a baseball game? One. More was better, but one would do, you know, one would do the job.
Yeah, well, at least you got to have one to hit and one to
That's right.
catch.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Let's go to Terre Haute. Line number, well, no, that person changed their mind. Instead, we will go to Champaign line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had two questions, if you have time for both of them.
Sure.
The first question is, my son, who is 8 years old, seems to have this recurrent problem with chalazion on the top of his eyelid that gets inflamed, and then his whole eyelid turns red, and then he ends up having to be put on antibiotics. I was wondering if there's anything that we could be doing to prevent that. And then the other question was, do you know about the use of Diamox in kids who are going to be going to high altitudes to prevent high altitude sickness?
Number two, no, I don't. Yeah, I'm really not aware of that at all, so I'll just leave that alone. The chalazion, the sty in the eye, sometimes, what that is it's an infected gland on the eyelid. And sometimes if it won't treat locally, and I presume after treatment it completely goes away and you see nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, if it ever gets to the point where it doesn't completely go away, sometimes the ophthalmologist will take that gland out, say, you know what, it's just a rotten gland, it's deformed, keeps reinfecting, let's just wedge it out, and let's just nip it out.
Okay.
But the Diamox...
We can keep doing the antibiotics intermittently. You don't have like a threshold for saying, well, listen, we got to really take care of this.
No.
Okay.
And a lot of people won't even treat these with antibiotics.
It gets nerve-wracking, though, when his whole eyelid...
Yeah, I think when the whole eyelid... If it stays local, a lot of physicians will just watch it. When the whole eyelid turns red...
Yeah, that's what we do. We try to watch it until
And I agree. When the whole eyelid turns red, you begin to worry because infections around the face and eye can, well, there's venous channels into the brain, and you have probably a little bit more risk of meningitis, and you say, you know what, this makes me a little nervous. I think I may bypass amoxicillin with this infection and go to a bigger gun, one that gives me more guarantees.
Yeah. Would Keflex, or is that not big enough?
Keflex is a good one.
Okay.
It's likely
to
do.
All right, well, thank you very
much. You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Back to another caller here. This would be Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi there. I'm calling about the woman who asked about her 9-year-old daughter. I think all the information you gave her about diet and exercise makes a lot of sense, but I think you forgot to look to the point of psychological, a young girl that's entering puberty that feels like she might be gaining weight. Any kind of diet changes that the mother tries to enforce should certainly be put to the girl with the idea of health, you know, fat causes, too much fat in your diet causes cancer, and too much sugar causes calories and diabetes, and not give the girl any kind of feeling that you're too fat and therefore you're ugly and you need to be careful of what you eat, because I think that too many young women in this society are too obsessed with what their appearances are and don't feel like they're hitting the mark, and it really is...
We have the eating disorders.
That's right. Whether it's too much eating or too little eating, people's ideas of themselves, girls in particular, seem to be judged on their outsides, and they need to work a lot more on what their insides are and think about health rather than beauty as far as weight and loss and gain.
Thank you.
Just thought I'd put those two points in.
Yeah, I'm not sure with this girl that of the earlier call... I'm not sure. Maybe perhaps anything needs to be done. You know, I think maybe she needs to be weighed, and find out if she really is overweight or if this is just sort of a repackaging through puberty where she looks over, where she looks plump, but indeed she isn't.
Well, whether that is true or not, it's possible that the girl just entering puberty is going to be obsessed with what they look
yeah.
like, whether it's accurate or inaccurate.
So it needs to be done tactfully.
With great skill and tact.
Yeah, great sensitivity, and preferably so she doesn't know there's any concern at all in this point, at this point until you know there is a problem.
That's right. Just thought I'd add those.
Okay.
Great,
yeah,
thank
thanks
you.
Thanks for the call. And we have about 10 minutes, or maybe a little bit more than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he is on the program every month and has been for quite a while on Thursday, and we talk about children's health and, you know, whatever kind of questions or comments or concerns you have, the kinds of things you might take up with a pediatrician. I mean, you can call us, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have that toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455.
You know, maybe a lot of our problems that we've talked about, kids are watching too much TV unsupervised. They're eating too many snacks, and obesity's problem in kids, obesity is a problem in adults. Maybe what we're saying is families ought to do things together more. And the weather's supposed to get, I think Mike said the weather's supposed to get nice this weekend.
I think so.
Go on out and, you know, dad doesn't have to turn over the garden. Maybe turning over the garden can be a family affair. And maybe turning over the garden is going to get done much more quickly this way, and there's going to be much more fun. And maybe there'll be time for a family baseball game. Or for the family to shoot some baskets together. And the whole family lose a little weight burn some calories up and have fun together. And the TV wouldn't be on, and the computer wouldn't be on, and computer games wouldn't be being played during this time. And just a suggestion.
Okay. Sounds like a good plan. Back to the phones here. We have somebody on our toll-free line, our line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for the show. I don't know if anyone's called in. I sort of came in late on this, but my wife and I are considering having children relatively soon. We're both vegetarians, but we're the type of vegetarians, we eat dairy and some dairy and lots
okay.
of fish. We're wondering when we have kids, I've heard some people say, let your kids eat everything, and we don't really, you know, we're not the type where we're going to force our eating habits on them, but there's really not going to be any pork, meat, or chicken in the house. We eat a lot of soy-based products, not a lot of milk or anything, but we do eat, like, dairy-based cheese. So what is a pediatrician's take on a child's health developing, I guess, from, you know, early, you know, from birth up until, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old?
Hey, go for it. You know, you're not vegans.
No, yeah.
That is a tough diet. To be strictly vegetarian is a tough diet. You need to go to the stores and seek out certain special beans and things that way to get this, mainly the sulfur containing amino acids. But you have you have a lot of fish in your diet. You have dairy products in your diet in the form of cheese. Did you say you eat eggs too?
Oh, yeah, we do eat eggs, yeah.
Okay. You know what? You're kind of meat-limited, but not vegetarian at all, so go for it. I don't see any problem at all.
Okay, great, because we'd always been kind of concerned. You know, a lot of people say let your child eat whatever they're going to eat, but we just don't really have any, you know, pork or chicken or meat-based products in the house.
So your children will still eat what they're going to eat, but the menu is, well, everybody's menu is limited. You've just chosen to limit yours in the pork and beef and chicken, but there's ample fish around and ample other food around, so go for it.
Okay, another question about the fish. We're big sushi fans. Like, we go out to restaurants and stuff. At what age do you, like, is it okay for a child to eat, like a raw fish type sushi from a restaurant? Because I know that at a certain age, their immune systems may not be as developed as an adult's immune system.
Wow, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I really don't know. I suspect if it's not making adults sick, it it's probably okay for a child to. I would guess there would be no problem with a young child eating sushi.
Okay, I have a niece that I take out for sushi a lot, and you know, up until 8 years old, she thought it was the grossest thing in the world. But then, you know, she's 9, 10 years old, she loves it now. And but you know, my relatives had asked if that was okay or not, and I said, you know, well, it hasn't made us sick, and we go to very, you know, reputable sushi restaurants.
Yeah.
We don't try to buy a piece of raw tuna at the store
yeah.
and then, you know, whack it up at home. But great,
and you're not
you
eating
much.
that funny fish that they have with the if you nick the gallbladder of the fish,
fugu.
It's terribly.
And we try to stay away from the. Tremendously, you know, exotic thing.
Yeah.
You know, we go to places around Champaign-Urbana and, you know, have great experiences and stuff. So, well, thanks for the info. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Right. Thank you. We have, again, we have time for a few other callers. If you want to pick up the telephone, give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. If, in a case like that, for example, if you were starting with a newborn, is there any problem with... using soy milk as a substitute, if for some reason the person decided they wanted to, that using that as a substitute for, well, I guess what you really would like for them to be, start out is to breastfeed.
Yeah, and I suspect this family will probably,
But then when it, you know, and then it comes time to go with something else to substitute soy milk, for example, rather than cow's milk, you would say,
go ahead,
okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
no,
because
no problem.
We certainly put babies, yeah. Even newborns on soy formula if they're presumptively allergic to cow's milk. Again, yeah, breastfeeding is first, but if you're not going to breastfeed,
yeah,
use a formula. The Carnation and Karo syrup, yeah, don't forget that one, that one of 30 years ago or whatever.
So how if you did have a newborn that was going to be allergic to cow's milk or a little one, it wouldn't be allergic to cow's milk, how would you know that, and when would you know that? Would you know that right as soon as you presented it? Would you know it?
Yeah, you'll know it soon. But you know, I think the other thing is cow's milk allergy is much much rarer than the number of kids flip-flopped from different formulas. It's probably less than 1% of the newborns are allergic to cow's milk. And the other thing is. About 15% of the kids that are known to be allergic to cow's milk are going to be allergic to the soy protein-based milk, too. So I think there's an awful lot of formula switching in babies that just really shouldn't be done. That's not necessary. It's sort of this too shall pass. Colic ends by 12 weeks of age. All babies are gassy. No, their gas doesn't smell any. Yeah, it doesn't. It's nobody bottles it and under the "Oh, the baby" label or anything like that, you know. And they do belch, and they have all the things that.
And that's all.
That's all pretty normal.
So that's not you. So there are people who, yeah. When that happens, it gets to be a problem. Then immediately they say, "Well,
it must be
the
formula intolerance."
The formula intolerance, and so we decide. Okay, we'll try something different.
The other thing, you know, we talk about milk allergies, a true allergy to the milk protein or some component of the milk protein. Then we talk about lactose intolerances and we just, some people lack the lactase, the enzyme in the intestinal tract that breaks up the milk sugar, lactose. This is quite, quite common in adults. This is probably, again, quite, quite uncommon in children. And that's the other advantage of a soy formula. You avoid the milk protein, but also lactose is not the predominant sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But again, milk intolerance is terribly uncommon. And when you think about it, boy, that's a good thing, because until 30 or 40 years ago, I don't know what these kids did before the protein hydrolysate formulas were invented and before the soy protein formulas came out and that sort of stuff. These kids were in real trouble.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wonder too about you know, when people talk about lactose intolerance, just is there some sort of continuum there, or is there some sort of hard line that you cross, and either you are or you're not? I mean, is it possible to be a lot intolerant or sort of a little bit intolerant?
You know, I think for most people it's a relative thing. They aren't completely, totally deficient in the lactase. But if they drink two glasses of milk, they may be in trouble. Whereas with one, they may be perfectly fine.
We are coming down here to the point we just about have to finish. Is there anything else that's on your mind you'd like to pass on to people before we say
I guess no sermon today, no lecture today. I think we've been in lots of diverse areas today. And again, spring is coming. Use it. Get outside. Work together as a family. Have fun together as a family. Burn up some calories. And you don't need to go to Dairy Queen as a treat. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Dr. Robert Bocek, he is a pediatrician, and he is on this program once a month. It's almost on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we talk about children's health. And, of course, your questions are welcome.